So there's this one girl who typically usually sits in front of me during this class, and she always has her laptop out and she's doing a puzzle.
Coming up on Carolina Connection, have laptops in class become more of a distraction? Good morning. I'm Mike Rodriguez.
And I'm Grace Joyle. Also this morning, UNC prepares to release results from its academic investigation that stemmed from the football scandal. A Chapel Hill couple helps fund the exploration of Blackbeard's ship. And we talk to a local Santa about what it takes to be the North Pole's most famous resident.
It takes more than a nice beard to be Santa. I've got special boots, special belts, but Santa Claus is in the heart and in the eyes, and the children know that.
From the UNC School of Journalism and Mass Communication, this is Carolina Connection.
Thank you for joining us this morning. We begin our coverage with the latest on the athletic investigation. The university announced yesterday that former Governor Jim Martin will present his findings about the investigation at a special Board of Trustees meeting the morning of December 20th. Then later that day, before a panel of the UNC Board of Governors. Martin has been investigating UNC's athletic scandal since August. Initially, he was scheduled to release his findings October 11th. The Daily Tar Heels University editor, Nicole Comparato, has been following the investigation since this summer and joins us now to bring us up to date. Thanks for joining us, Nicole.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So what can you tell me about former Governor Jim Martin's investigation?
Well, I know it's been going on since late August, and he hasn't really given much of an indication of what he's found so far. I do know that he and the consulting firm, Baker Tilly Virchow Krause, it's a mouthful, but they've been working and conducting interviews with professors, with students, with faculty, people in the athletics department, just anywhere. And they've been doing tons of interviews, at least recently. And basically, I have an idea at this point that they've interviewed maybe hundreds of people, because when we talked to him back in, you know, late September, when they still had that original October 11th deadline, that was originally when he had planned to present the results of the findings, or his findings. And back then, he had already interviewed, I think, 50 people. So I'm imagining by now, they've got a lot of people up there. And, you know, so far they've said it's been delayed just because it takes so long to go through all these records. They're going through all the academic records and, you know, course histories and grades people got in that sense. So that's why they've said it's been taking so long. So as much as we know so far, we're not sure what's going to come out of it, but we do know that it's not specific to the AFAM department. It is cross-departmental. They are looking at all departments on campus, you know, trying to put this thing to rest and just make sure they get everything out so no other surprises come out in the future.
All right, so moving away from Martin's investigation specifically, sort of going back over the past month, what are the most recent revelations pertaining to the investigation at UNC?
Well, the most recent thing has actually been Governor Martin's review, because that's been what everyone's been waiting for. And after that happens, Hunter Rawlings is supposed to take over this other academic review and kind of see how we're going to move forward and bridge this gap between athletics and academics. So really everything's been on, you know, standstill until Governor Martin finishes his review. And obviously it's been 2 months at least since the October deadline. So, you know, the sooner we get all this out, the sooner people are going to be able to move on. And that's what Governor Martin's told me before, is he said, you know, even if it's going to be painful when the results come out, and, you know, if there's going to be something there that people aren't going to really appreciate about their school, as long as we're making the efforts to get them out and get rid of them, get rid of the problem, then we're on our way. There was a article by the NNO with Mary Willingham, and they've kind of told everyone that she was a whistleblower in all this sense, but in terms of what that actually comes out to be, it's kind of just her giving her account into what exactly happened. And I do know that she's met with Governor Martin to tell him what she's known about this. And just for a little background, basically the article goes into account of her experience as a counselor in the athletics department. So that's the most recent thing. But like I said, it's not really, you know, a new discovery. It's just one person who came forward to tell her story. And I think people have maybe taken that, you know, and run with it. So that, in that sort of sense.
That's Nicole Comparato, University Editor for the Daily Tar Heel. Nicole, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Grace.
It's our final show of the semester, which means classes are finished and we're in the middle of exams. While some students can simply look up the date of a lecture on their computer, others have to thumb through a semester's worth of handwritten notebook pages to study. That's because some UNC professors no longer allow students to bring computers or other electronic devices to class. UNC's MBA program doesn't go that far, but it's recently put in place a rule that allows students to use tablet devices, but not laptops.
The reason for these rules is that some professors feel laptop screens make it harder to see their students. And of course, they don't want students to succumb to the temptations of shoe shopping, watching Saturday Night Live skits, and checking their email. Ashley Fernandez reports on the return of pencils and paper in the classroom.
Students scurry into Professor Jane Thurlow-Krill's last English class of the semester. As Thurlow-Krill begins to lecture, some students sit with a pen and paper taking notes, while others type on computers. One of Thurlow-Krill's students, junior global studies major Niriam Hinkle, says she does not use a computer in the class because she can focus better taking her notes by hand. Hinkle says it's very disturbing when other students use laptops for things other than class.
So there's this one girl who typically usually sits in front of me during this class, and she always has her laptop out and she's doing a puzzle, and it's just really distracting. I just can't help but stare at the puzzle, and it makes me frustrated.
Educators in the Kenan Flagler School of Business agree with the idea that laptops and electronic devices can be distracting for some of their students. This year, the MBA program has enacted a flat device policy. This means that students can bring in flat tablets such as iPads to class. Associate Dean Sweetheart Velasubramanian says laptops are not allowed.
Now, the problem with that is that the regular laptop screen is always up, and therefore it obstructs the view of the student from the professor's perspective. And what we found that created a distracting atmosphere in class, both for the professor and for the students. So this year we have modified that.
Some professors go even further than that and ban all electronic devices, both laptops and flat devices. Junior double major in journalism and exercise and sports science, Sydney Harris, is in a class like that. Harris, who normally takes her notes on her laptop, says that she was able to adapt to taking notes by hand, but says that students should have the right to take notes however they please.
When professors lay down their foot like that, then it really is to better us as students, because they have watched kids go through their class before, so they know what's going to help us. And I guess in the long run, as a student, I would say I should be able to make my decision for myself, though.
Junior psychology major Morgan Markham agrees that students should be allowed to use laptops because it's faster than writing. If other students use their computers to slack off in class, that doesn't bother her.
If I see someone on Facebook, and I'm not on Facebook, it just makes me feel like, oh, well, I'm doing a better job than them, so it doesn't really distract me at all.
Thurlow-Krill, the English professor, says that she allows students to use electronic devices for taking notes and looking up class material because it can be helpful.
I guess my feeling is students can not learn without any tools to help them. Students cannot learn with a laptop. Both those things are true. On the other hand, there's a lot to be accomplished by using a laptop within the context of a classroom and a dynamic discussion.
Thurlow-Krill says that she knows that some students use their laptops to check emails or chat with their friends on Facebook, but she says that those students aren't likely to do well when she issues their grades. In Chapel Hill, I'm Ashley Fernandez.
With Carolina's fall semester coming to an end, some seniors will graduate during winter break. A recent study suggests that graduation rates of African-American men at UNC are lagging. They're taking longer to get their diplomas, if they graduate at all. Avery Harper reports.
Nick Johnson has been at UNC for 4 years. He changed his major from biology to photojournalism after 2 years, so he'll be on campus for one more, a fifth-year senior.
I was pretty much kind of miserable for the first 2 years.
He joins a large group. According to the university's Office of Undergraduate Institutional Research, less than half of African-American males will graduate within 4 years. 13% take 5 or 6 years to complete their degree, and 22% of African-American men never graduate. Director of Diversity Education and Research, Dr. Melva Newsom, says reasons for these low rates start in grade school.
They're frequently not encouraged to be academically excellent. They're encouraged to be athletically excellent.
That emphasis on athletic excellence may be one factor, but it's not the only one. Some argue that mentorship and strong relationships with faculty aren't a big enough part of the undergraduate experience for African-American men.
Because our faculty is predominantly white, a lot of our black males don't want to act like they're not supposed to be here.
Johnson says a mentor could have helped him stay on track.
I wasn't quite sure who to talk to.
There are numerous resources available at UNC. But Josmel Perez, Multicultural Affairs Program Director, says many of those resources focus on helping first-year and transfer students.
We haven't had enough success in reaching those juniors and seniors that we need to round out their experiences.
And although it's too late for Johnson to graduate on time, he says he's excited to finish out his fifth year strong. In Chapel Hill, I'm Avery Harper.
Coming up on Carolina Connection, scientists restore artifacts from the ship of an infamous pirate. You're listening to Carolina Connection, UNC's student-produced newscast. I'm Mike Rodriguez.
And I'm Grace Joyle. Despite ever-changing shopping, dining, and entertainment options throughout the decades, Franklin Street has remained a popular destination. In recent years, there's been a big change downtown. Large-scale developments don't just change the skyline. They're meant to inspire a new way of using downtown amenities. Carolina Connection's Abraham Jaruzelski reports.
Downtown Chapel Hill doesn't look as it did even just 5 years ago. Mixed-use developments such as Greenbridge and the soon-to-be-completed 140 West Franklin mean the future is looking up, literally. The town is also entertaining proposals for similar redevelopment of University Square. 140 West Franklin is coming up on what used to be a town-owned parking lot. Mayor Mark Kleinschmidt says 140 West will create a more consistent downtown.
Before this construction began, it was a parking lot, and it created a gap between east and west. The Aveda Institute at one point was the Michael Jordan restaurant, and it failed. You know, and people weren't making it this far down Franklin Street whenever they'd come visit.
140 West offers a mix of retail space with several floors of condominiums. Kleinschmidt says its large blocks of retail space allow for an anchor store, such as a supermarket, that Franklin Street does not have the space for now. Nina Martin is an assistant professor in UNC's geography department, specializing in the economic development of cities. She says mixed-use developments can attract young professionals who value a vibrant downtown.
We want to be able to hold on to people who can make a great contribution to this town and also to provide opportunities for graduates to stay. So creating a town that provides for different kinds of lifestyles for people, I think, is a huge advantage.
But not everyone benefits from these redevelopment projects. Martin says mixed-use developments can increase property values and subsequently taxes.
Also, it can increase property rents, home prices more generally. So for instance, the Greenbridge development, a lot of people have felt that it's had these negative impacts on the adjacent Northside neighborhood.
This displacement is of particular concern in Northside, the traditionally African-American working-class neighborhood just north of downtown. Higher home values have led some residents to sell their homes. These homes are often bought by developers, who refurbish or rebuild the homes and then can rent them out to several students at a time. With condominiums rising and student housing growing, the Northside neighborhood is changing rapidly. Paris Miller has lived there with her husband for over a decade. They say they don't resent the students for living in their neighborhood and also don't fault the business people for trying to make a profit from flipping homes in their neighborhood. But Miller is concerned about how their young son will grow up.
I love this neighborhood. I love the history that it has, but I hate that it's transitioned away from a place where my son can have that experience of living in a neighborhood, you know, have sleepovers and play with his friends.
Miller and her husband, Gerald Fushi, live in what used to be Gerald Fushi's grandmother's house. As I walk with Fushi down North Roberson Street near the Hargroves Recreation Center, he shows me what houses are now occupied by students that used to be single-family homes.
About 12 properties on this strip here are owned by people who are not from this neighborhood or people who've been living here less than 5 years. It's kind of sad to see that, you know, these houses will probably always be student housing, no matter what.
Kleinschmidt says students moving into the Northside neighborhood is not a result of Greenbridge and has been going on for decades, but it is still a problem the town and the university are addressing. As for maintaining the character of Franklin Street, he says that has always been changing.
This town has never stayed the same, you know. People have ideas of what this town is that become set and concretized in their minds when they graduate and move away, and then they're shocked when they come back. But I'll tell you, that's the experience of UNC alumni going back 200 years.
In Chapel Hill, I'm Abraham Jaruzelski.
A Chapel Hill couple has made its mark on history, a history that's 300 years in the making. The husband and wife donated more than $30,000 to the archaeological expedition of Blackbeard's infamous ship. Mark Haywood reports on how their money will be spent.
Eric and Rita Bigham have lived in Chapel Hill since 1968. Years ago, the two of them vacationed in Beaufort, North Carolina. It's become their second home.
Like all good people, we came to Beaufort on a boat the first time, and since then, we've fallen in love with the town.
The town's history includes a man named Edward Teach. You may know him as the swashbuckling pirate, Blackbeard. In 1718, his ship, the Queen Anne's Revenge, ran aground off the shores of Beaufort. Fast forward to 1996, a salvage company discovers the ship. The state has been recovering and restoring artifacts ever since. This fall, Governor Beverly Perdue spoke at an event about the restoration project.
Basically, the governor actually said when she was speaking about the need for donations, she said, well, get out your checkbook.
So Bigham and his wife wrote a check for $32,500.
It just clicked with us that we just knew when we heard it. And my wife was really more enthusiastic about it than I was.
The Bigham's gift will help to finance work here at the QAR Conservation Lab at East Carolina University. Conservators like Shauna Daniel work to clean a few centuries' worth of muck from the ship's relics and trinkets.
Let's go in here and actually get to see a conservator at work.
Daniel enters a room where a woman sits diligently scrubbing solidified silt called a concretion from a pewter plate. Daniel leaves the lab and walks to a warehouse out back. Inside, large containers filled with a special solution hold some of the larger artifacts. Daniel uncovers a container revealing a cannon that she says could weigh over 1,000 pounds.
This is a cannon. Now, cannons, we give them numbers like cannons 18. This is C18.
Daniel says cannon can take a year and a half to clean. She says they must be kept in a type of salty solution so that they aren't corroded. Once cleaned, an electric current runs through the water to draw out the salts.
A lot of people think, you know, with the water and stuff, like, can you put your hand in the water? And you can, you know, it's not going to hurt you, I promise.
So far, Daniel says over a ton of cannon have been discovered, along with smaller items like buttons, cufflinks, pins, and even gold dust. She says it's gratifying to be one of the first people to see these artifacts.
Wow, you know, I'm one of the first people that have touched this, and I'm getting that chance to do that, so that's always cool.
Back in the lab, Daniel says a goal for the project is to understand more about life in the 18th century, which, even for pirates, can include some practices people don't often talk about.
What we have found recently is something quite interesting, and it's called a clyster syringe, which it was used to enemas. Back in the especially early 1700s, they used it as this was a fad.
All of the artifacts, both common and unusual, are sent to the North Carolina Maritime Museum and even the Smithsonian. Daniel says Blackbeard is a part of North Carolina history that should be shared with the public. Bigham and his wife have similar feelings.
My wife is a former teacher. She's an retired elementary school teacher. She knows that a lot of children are really interested in pirates. And she thought that the Queen Anne's Revenge artifacts and the displays that will come for them will help interest children in learning about history and not only about pirates.
While Bigham says this was a one-time donation, he hopes to be able to continue to support the North Carolina Maritime Museum in the future. He says it's a good feeling knowing that he could be part of bringing the Queen Anne's Revenge to the public. In Chapel Hill, I'm Mark Haywood.
Luis Fernandez now joins us for sports. Luis, it's exam week, but some teams are still playing, aren't they?
Yeah, Mike, there's not too much going on. The UNC men's basketball team had the past week off, so I'm sure they got most of their studying in already. The Heels return to the Dean Dome tonight when they play 2-4 East Tennessee State University at 7:30. You can listen to the pregame show at 6 o'clock here on 97.9 WCHL. After coming off of a strong performance against the Blazers, putting up 102 points, Carolina is expected to get back starting freshman point guard Marcus Page. Page practiced fully on Thursday after jamming his shoulder in practice last Friday. UNC is currently 5-0 all-time against ETSU, although it has been quite some time since these two ball clubs met. 1987, to be precise. The Tar Heels and Toys for Tots will be teaming up for something far more important than basketball. Carolina fans are encouraged to bring toys to the game tonight and donate them to the charity organization as they try to give over 5,000 Orange County children the holiday they deserve. Collection bins will be located outside of every entrance to the Dean Smith Center tonight. On Sunday, the UNC women's soccer team won their 21st NCAA title after a roller coaster ride of a season. Jane Porter talks about the championship coming back to Carolina.
Students, families, and soccer fans came out to Carmichael Stadium Thursday to celebrate the Tar Heel Women's Soccer Championship with the team and its coaches. And celebrate they should, because this season was fraught with adversity. Between multiple injuries and star players being away for much of the season in international tournaments, the team's path to winning the NCAA was never an easy one. The ACC quarterfinal game against Virginia, where the Heels fell 1-0 at home, was a particularly tough loss for Dorrance.
Our loss to Virginia was the most my team has been dominated in the history of the University of North Carolina. Even in losses, we're rarely dominated, but they completely outclassed us and dominated us. So that was very discouraging and devastating.
But that early ACC tournament loss had a silver lining. It gave the team time to prepare for the NCAA, and it was time well spent. Former team captain Amber Brooks is proud her last season ended the same way as her first, with a national title.
It's just picture perfect ending. I'm so thankful. You know, as a senior, you kind of hope that the girls beneath you send you out on top with a bang, and that's what I wanted to do as a freshman, and I'm just very thankful that my teammates were able to step up and do the same for me.
Coach Dorrance has won 21 NCAA titles in the 30 years that the title has existed for women's soccer, but he says he doesn't take the credit for keeping his players motivated.
There are no tricks in motivation. To some extent, motivation is a really quirky and inconsistent thing to do. And the way I look at it is it's not my obligation to motivate them. I mean, if you can't get motivated, I'll find someone else.
That may be his opinion, but at least one player on the team disagrees.
He's just really, definitely one of the best coaches I've ever had, and I think one of the best coaches of all time. He's, you know, he says he doesn't motivate us, but I would say that motivating us is probably one of his greatest strengths.
So, how are the Heels looking for next year?
We're going to be better. We've recruited incredibly well, and even though we've lost some fabulous players, the recruiting class is tremendous.
That's what the fans at Carmichael and countless others like to hear. In Chapel Hill, I'm Jane Porter.
21 NCAA championships. Talk about dominance. The next closest school is Notre Dame. It only has 3 titles. Of course, we can't go an entire show without talking about football. This time, the players are dressed a little smaller than usual. Brenna Sukier has a story.
Meet the Durham Eagles. It's a nonprofit organization that teaches children the values of discipline, self-respect, and especially success through playing football. Don Jones started the Eagles in 1993. Its aim? Keeping kids off the street and on the field.
Started out, it was just going to be a football program. You know, we were going to teach kids football and go from football to, you know, other sports and, you know, transition like that. But it was pretty quick that you found out that, you know, the kids are looking to you for a lot more than that.
Volunteers like head coach Antonio Beattie give up time every week to train the Eagles, and they do more than just run drills on the field.
I make sure they bring me their report cards and their progress reports. I even go visit the kids in school.
7-year-old Tashawn Smith says being part of the Eagles has helped him in school.
It helps you in school by staying focused. You can learn more, and your grades can be better.
And Smith's mother has also noticed an improvement in her son's academic performance thanks to the Eagles.
Teacher tell me that, you know, he's doing a good job, and I just figured that with sports and academics, they, you know, pretty much go hand in hand.
Smith's dream? To play football professionally. Jones says that's what makes the program work.
Football's just a magnet. It gets them here, gets us an opportunity to be in front of them, give them a chance to make some, you know, talk to them about making good decisions.
And whether or not any of these Eagles end up in the NFL or the NCAA, it's clear they're flying high. In Durham, I'm Brenna Sukier.
With that kind of support, Mike, you know those kids have a bright future to look forward to.
Wow, that sounds like a great organization. That's Luis Fernandez reporting sports. Thanks, Luis.
Thanks, Mike.
'Tis the season when children eagerly await the goodies Santa will leave under the Christmas tree. Before Santa's annual flight, seasonal Santas set up shop at local malls to give children the chance to share their holiday wishes. What does it take to be the man with the snow-white beard and the red suit? Alex Risk talked to one local Mr. Claus, who says it takes more than a hearty ho-ho-ho.
Every day during the holiday season, families here line up and wait, often for an hour or more, just so their kids can have a brief visit with Santa. Or in this case, with Santa Jim.
It takes a special personality, a gift, I think, to be Santa.
Jim Dyer has been a professional Santa for about 20 years. Dyer served in the Army as an infantry officer and then became a chaplain. He says the reason we celebrate Christmas starts with St. Nicholas. The work is, well, seasonal.
But I've been growing a beard every year for the last 20 years. And I shave it off every year and start back.
I caught up to Santa Jim in the coffee shop where he takes his much-needed daily break from what he calls his time in the chair. He says he enjoys being Santa, but the hours are long and the job is demanding.
Every child that comes in is the only child in line. Even if there's a long line, you have to focus on that child, not the next one. You are wide open all day long.
Santa Jim meets all kinds of children.
You know, a lot of the children tell me they love me, which is nice. But occasionally a child will come in that needs to have his mouth washed out with soap.
And all kinds of parents. That's the squeaky toy the photographer uses to get kids to look at the camera.
You're not smiling right. You're smiling too big. You're not showing your teeth. You're showing too much teeth. I'm amazed. Sometimes I'll sit there for 2 hours, and almost every parent comes through is critical of their child's smile.
Santa Jim also worries that when parents encourage kids to bring long lists of expensive toys, they're not teaching them what Christmas is all about.
I don't think my role is to promise them the world.
But that's not always the case.
They'll come in and I've had children say, what I would like to really have is to know that some of the poor children in the world are getting gifts, are in warm homes, and are in loving homes. That does happen.
And some children ask for things even Santa can't deliver.
A little girl came in the other day. She says, I want my mom to stop being angry with my father. A little young man chased me up the stairs the other day as I was leaving and said, I want my mom and dad to get back together.
Being Santa requires some special skills, like being able to name all of Santa's reindeer. He even jingles when he walks.
Boots jingle.
But as Santa Jim is quick to point out, it's much more than that.
It takes more than a nice beard to be Santa. I've got special boots, special belts, but Santa Claus is in the heart and in the eyes, and the children know that.
Santa Jim says this will be his last year working full-time at the mall.
It's exhausting. I love it, but it's exhausting.
Still, for as long as he has the stamina, he will be Santa.
Ho, 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 ho. Merry Christmas.
In Raleigh, I'm Alex Risk.
Well, this is our final show of the semester, and we'd like to thank all of our listeners. We wouldn't have a show without you.
Also, a big thanks goes to Wesley Graham, our production manager, our advisor, Adam Hochberg, and my co-anchor, Grace Joyle, who's graduating this month.
Thanks, Mike.
This group was a lot of fun. So for this week and this semester, that's Carolina Connection, a production of the UNC School of Journalism and Mass Communication. I'm Mike Rodriguez.
And I'm Grace Joyle. You can hear current stories and past shows by visiting our website, carolinaconnection.org. Have a great weekend. And as always,
go Heels!